Okay, we are past 7:30, so I think we can go ahead and get started. So if we have any new people with us tonight, welcome. As always, we welcome guests at the Ottawa PC User Group meetings. If you want to join, I've pasted into the chat window a URL you can go to with details and how you can join our happy little band. So tonight, reminder, we are recording things, and the recording, the audio recording, and the contents of the chat window and the deck in PDF format will be going up on our website, so you can peruse all of that stuff at your leisure. I'm now going to mute all, and you will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you want to make a comment or a question, please remute yourself afterwards. Keep background noise to a minimum. We don't have a huge agenda tonight. We do have a poll that we're going to be doing a little bit later in the evening. It went out on the announcement list, so hopefully everybody had a chance to look at that, and I'll be introducing that after we go through our regular agenda items. Because it looks like we probably will have a fair amount of time tonight, don't forget, we do have our final 10, in which anybody who's interested can raise additional questions, comments, questions, anything of that sort. So get that all ready. You can throw it into the chat window ahead of time if you want, or wait until that time comes up and then turn your microphone on and ask or comment audibly. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And yes, I agree. I think we should have time for additional questions and discussion at the end. So let's get going. And this is the first meeting, first Q&A of 2024. So courtesy of Linda, our photo guru, here's a happy new year to you all from Chris and I and the rest of the board. And I guess in the new year, you always do a retrospective, right? So Chris is our statistician. He's been keeping track of all these wonderful numbers. So if you look back over the last couple of years or so, 167 Zoom sessions, and we've covered almost 1,200 topics in that time, and have seen almost 6,000 people in front of their screens. So it's been a really successful enterprise. However, we're always looking for more and we need some assistance. So if we look ahead, the kind of things that we need people to come up with, the question that's burning a hole in your brain, you desperately need to know the answer, anything that's computer related, and certainly shares of favorite computer programs or smartphone apps or neat pieces of hardware that you've obtained in the, what would it be? It would be the Christmas sales, I guess, or we have New Year's sales. Anyway, any interesting programs or software or hardware, we always like to hear about it. We have Loony Links, so websites that are Canadian, essentially Canadian in nature, or things that you found interesting on places like YouTube. And we don't really know what you don't know. So one of the problems in, you know, preparing material is we really need to know what would be of interest to people. And we have these two series called Computer Basics and Smartphone Basics. And we've covered a whole bunch of topics in those in the past few years. But again, if there's things that we haven't covered that you're really not sure about or you would like to know about, you'd like to know more about, if you let us know what they are, then we can find somebody who will provide some information. So as always, anything you want to tell us goes into suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll be happy to trying to accommodate you. And speaking of which, here's a share that came in, which Chris is going to talk about.
Yeah, so this came in from Serge Eric. Thank you very much for that, Serge. It's a program called Battery Limiter. And so if you have a problem with your laptop battery not lasting as long as it used to, it could be because you've been overcharging it. And we've talked about this a number of times, the concept of overcharging and what you can do about it. And Serge Avic came up with this interesting program that can help you in that event. So it's called Battery Limiter. It's free. And it's a pretty simple, small program, and it will alarm you. I think it'll alarm you. It'll set off an alarm when your charge capacity hits whatever you decide is the limit. The default is 80%, but you can set it anywhere from 30% to 96%. And when the alarm goes off, all you have to do is unplug the laptop to stop the charging, and the alarm will go off. And there are lots of configuration options on it. I first thought I was just going to do one slide on this, but I actually installed it on one of my laptops, and it's kind of cool. It's got a lot of options to it. So next. So when it goes off, so when your battery reaches the limit, however it's been set, you get this dialog box coming up down near the system tray, and it actually pulses. So it gets larger and smaller on a cycle, but every second or so, and the alarm will go off, and that will stay on the screen. And it's kind of hard to miss this, believe me. And so you'll get that coming up near the system clock. So next. So again, all you have to do is unplug your laptop, and the alarm will go off, and the visual cue, the pulsing box there, goes away, and the sounds will stop. Next. And if you want to configure it, you can click on that window, or if you want to configure it before the alarm goes off, there's a system tray icon that you can click on, and it'll bring up the configuration screen. Next. So this is the way it looks, and there's a little bit of information at the top. You know, it says start, charge status high, and, you know, it has a thing about estimated battery life, and I don't know what that really does or anything like that. I think you have to run it for a period of time before it'll actually come up with anything there. It'll tell you what your charge limit is set to for the high end and the low end, and it'll tell you your current battery level. Next. And if you want to configure it to a different battery limit, you can drag that slider to a new location on the bar. Now, an interesting thing, which I found kind of annoying and kind of weird, if you look over on the left-hand side, next. Oh, sorry. Yeah, okay, another thing you can do is click the speaker icon to silence the alarm, but beware of doing that, because if you click that speaker icon, you're basically telling it you don't want any sound anymore in the future, until you actually go back into this dialog box and click the speaker icon again to turn it on. So that's not the best way to silence it. The best way is to actually pull the plug, and it'll stop charging and the alarm will go off. Next. And so the thing I found a little bit weird was these icons that are sort of off to the edge. And this isn't that I cropped that dialog box and crop that off. This is the way it actually appears. If you hover the mouse over those little partial icons, next, they'll actually slide into view. And that's where you can get into, well, the first one is you can advertise for this guy on social media or whatever, but the middle icon is a tool icon, next. And you just click on that, and that'll bring you up to the main settings menu, next. And so in here, you have a whole bunch of options you can set. So the first is sound duration. The default is infinity. And so that means the alarm will just go off and it'll stay going until such time as you actually pull the plug on the laptop. But you can set it to go off automatically after 1 minute or 10 minutes. Next. You can also set up your sound that will go off, and there's a number of pre-configured ones, and if you don't like any of those, you can actually load up a custom sound file. It'll take a number of formats, WAV files, MP4s, and there's a bunch of different file formats that it will accept if you want to have your own custom sound. Next. And then there is a low charge battery indicator as well, so you can have it actually alarm you when the battery is running low, which is kind of cool. You can then plug it in to get things charged up again. And it is on by default at 10%. Next. And you can choose a color theme if you don't like the default color theme. And I think I switched it to that yellow. And for me, it just happened to work fairly well, but you can choose any of the color themes that are listed there. Next. So there's a few things you want to keep in mind when you're using this program. First off is battery limiter is a little bit of a misnomer in that it doesn't limit battery charging. Okay. It just tells you with in your face and your ears notifications when whatever you've set as the battery charge level is exceeded. It does not stop the laptop from actually charging beyond that. Next. If you, in the default configuration for it, it will keep the laptop from going to sleep if the lid of the laptop is open. And the reason it does this is so that it can keep running, doesn't go to sleep, in which case it can't alarm you. And so it will keep on running so that it can alert you. If you really want it to go to sleep, you just close the lid. The default for Windows is that if you close the lid, it goes to sleep. You can set that in the power settings if you change it to something else or whatever. But if you close the lid, that will, by default, allow the laptop to go to sleep. Of course, at that point in time, it's not going to be alarming you anymore. Next. And a reminder that if you mute the alarm by clicking the speaker icon when it pops up, it will stay muted. It'll still come up with the visual indicator, but the speaker will stay off until you actually re-enable that. And this will survive even through a reboot or anything like that. You're telling it you no longer want to have sound. So to mute the alarm just, you know, temporarily and have it come back next time you reach the battery limit, you know, just remove the power cord and it'll stop that way. Next. And there are a few configuration changes that don't take effect until the program is restarted. You can always reboot your computer to restart the program, but you can also right-click the icon in the system tray and choose Exit, and then restart the program from the Start menu. It'll be an icon on your Start menu. And so if you make any configuration changes and it doesn't seem to be taking effect, just restart the program and you'll be good to go. So all in all, I think pretty cool program. It's free. Try it out. If you find it useful, that's great. If not, uninstall it. That's all for that. Thanks again to Serge Eric.
So Natalie's asking, do you know if battery limiter is very different from AccuBattery?
I don't know because I have not used AccuBattery.
And Tom notes that many laptops can have battery charging automatically limited.
Yeah.
And he's put a link in there, so if you want to check out your particular computer, then look it up on the web.
Yeah, we did talk about that before, and it's really good to do it that way because it will actually limit it. I have that on my Lenovo, and so it goes off after 80%. But this is kind of cool. If you either have I just see cannot unmute from Tom. I'll check that. If you have a laptop that either doesn't allow you to limit it, or you might want to have this set to an alarm that it's, you know, before the limit is reached or something like that. So you could use both the laptop's capability as well as this program if you wanted.
So Tom's trying to tell us that AccuBattery is only for Android devices.
Yeah. Could somebody else try to unmute and tell me if you are unable to unmute? Because the only way I can check, I can basically just remute everybody with the ability to unmute. Okay, let me try.
Come on, Bob Walker, you're up next.
Yeah, Bob will be able to unmute because he's a co-host.
Oh. Stuart, come on, Stuart. Be brave.
Okay, I'm going to, just to interrupt here just for a moment, just to correct this. I'm going to mute all and allow you to unmute. So Alan and Bob, you'll have to unmute yourselves now. So
working
everybody
now.
Should have the ability now to unmute.
Working.
Yeah, it's working now.
Okay. My screw
okay,
up, sorry.
Thanks for that, Tom. Okay, so talking about Bob Walker, Bob has some more information on good and bad reviews. Review on reviews, Bob.
Okay, let me just share my screen here. And there we go. Okay, we're going to cover a bit more on reviews. We looked at product reviews online in the past, presentations on cross-border and online shopping back in 2019. And on the online shopping during COVID-19 back in 2020. This is some more information about online reviews, both on retailers' websites and on dedicated review sites. I decided to do this because a couple of weeks ago I covered some fraud alerts, and part of that was about phony review sites. So I thought I'd just add to it tonight. Online reviews can be very useful for comparing products and services, especially if you're set to lay down some money for them. There's two major types of reviews. One is reviews from users of the product giving their sometimes biased comments and opinions. And there's reviews based on impartial testing, which are supposed to be unbiased. And whatever through sites like Wirecutter, Consumer Reports, and many, many more. User reviews, the more user reviews an item has, the more accurate they tend to be, as the results are averaged out by larger samples. So you get one or two crackpots in there, and there's 1,000 reviews, that'll be averaged out. The American version of a website, for example, Amazon, may have up to 20 times more user reviews on the same item. And sometimes the Canadian site also contains reviews from the American site, especially with Amazon. User reviews on sites like Amazon and Home Depot, I have found anyway, tend to be relatively fairly accurate. Some other major sites, not so much. I've posted some reviews on Best Buy and Canadian Tire, and they tend to edit out or not post the more negative ones, and Best Buy has actually edited out some of the negative comments and otherwise posted the review. So that's a bit of a problem. Comparing different similar items on a single website, for example, Amazon, tends to be more accurate than comparing the same item across different websites. This is due to the differences in the processes used by the different websites to collect or enter the reviews, and we'll cover this a bit more later. Comparing reviews on a website that edits and filters negative reviews with a website that doesn't won't give comparable results. That said, going to several websites to compare their reviews on the same item can be a real eye-opener for you. It may help you gauge the accuracy and biases of the particular website you're getting the main review from. When comparing reviews of several items on the same category, for example, let's say you're looking to buy a new mouse for your computer, Amazon often highlights one as Amazon's choice. Just fair warning, this isn't necessarily the best product in that category, but it's the one with a combination of the best average reviews, fewest returns, best profit margin for Amazon, and other such things. Manufacturers' website reviews tend to be less accurate than the retailers' websites, since there's more of an incentive for the manufacturers to fudge things a bit. And many reviews on manufacturers' websites are not actually reviews at all, but are testimonials disguised as reviews. And sometimes if you read the very, very finest of the fine print, they'll state this. And also some of the reviews may be from a promotional event, such as we'll give you the product free if you give us a good review of it. Some sites like Canadian Tire port in some of their reviews from the manufacturer's sites, so or the supplier's websites, and so you get the biases of those websites on what you think is the retailer's website. On many sites, the process of giving a user review steers you towards giving a positive review. you have to check off things like, was the product packed properly? Was the delivery time as promised? Was the customer service polite and courteous? If you did have to contact customer service. And not a lot of the questions are actually about the product itself. And on some of these sites, if you give a less than 5-star review, they want you to explain why. And that acts as a bit of a disincentive from giving a less than 5-star review. The 2, 3, and 4-star user reviews can be more informative than the 1 or the 5-star reviews because the reviewers are less concerned with getting the review process over with quickly and more concerned with passing on useful information. Reviews from people that just received the product are less accurate and realistic than the reviews from people that actually use the product over a period of time. I get this a lot on sites like Amazon, where if you read the actual 5-star reviews, some people with comments like, "I just received this and it's just wonderful," and they haven't actually even used the product yet, or they just used it briefly, and given that result, and less sometimes the reviews can be like a 1-star review. The product arrived late, so I returned it. And nothing about the product itself. So you really want to read the reasons people give for the score. And on some of the 2, 3, and 4-star reviews, if they give reasons relating to an issue that is important to you about the product, it might change your mind. It can also be very revealing of the biases or issues that the reviewer has that are not really related to the product itself. Fake reviews. The advertisers, marketers, and other stakeholders are often motivated to produce fake positive reviews for products they wish to promote, or fake negative reviews for the competitors' products that they wish to disparage. And there's a whole gray industry in the shadows of the internet dedicated to posting false reviews, both positive and negative. So you gotta watch out for these. Some sites like Amazon are taking measures such as verifying that the reviewers have actually bought the product, and of course they know that because they bought the product from Amazon. And they give more weight to reviews from regular known reviewers, to people that regularly review products on Amazon, than to somebody that just comes out of the shadows. That said, if you do a review on Amazon on your own, like you go to review the product on your own, you go to the product page and click on the give a review box, you basically have a blank sheet to deal with unprompted. But quite often Amazon sends me an email requesting that I do a review on a product that I've recently bought. And if you click on this to do the review, it usually has you go through a questionnaire with stuff like, did you receive it on time? Yada, yada, yada. And quite often I get these requests to review the product before I've even actually received the product. That's the problem of living out in the country. You don't get the 2-day delivery. The other form of reviews besides user reviews are reviews based on impartial testing. Reviews on sites that create the reviews based on impartial testing tend to be much more accurate and comparable than user reviews. And quite often the site will describe what their review or testing process is, so you can see if they're looking at or testing for features that are of interest to you or important to you. Testing-based review sites include, and I make a note that this is far from a complete list, sites like Consumers Reports, and this is a paid site, you have to buy a subscription to it, the New York Times and Wirecutter, which is a division of New York Times, PC Magazine does a lot of reviews, CNET, Trustpilot, and there's many, many other legitimate review sites. And as I noticed a couple weeks ago in the fraud alerts presentation I gave, in that presentation we looked at how to spot phony or fraudulent review websites that are set up by different companies to give their product a very positive review it doesn't actually deserve. And sort of related to reviews, but not quite. I do a lot of cooking, so I'm always looking for new recipes to try. And when searching for new recipes, I often use the review scores on the internet when I'm doing a search for a type of recipe to determine which recipes of any given type I'm going to look at first. However, I get a lot of other great useful information on the comments section at the bottom of the web page for a particular recipe. And in some cases, that's much more useful than the actual review. Recipe websites are like a lot of the others. There's a tendency on some of them to fudge the reviews that they get. And that's it for tonight.
Thanks, Bob. Natalie's asking, has there been legislation that mandates disclosure if someone was being paid to review a product?
Yeah, a lot of the websites will note that any products they mention on the website, that they get a bit of back pay for if you follow the link to that site. And that's how they fund the site, is by giving links to the different products. And you know, as long as they're honest about it and upfront, that's great. You know what the bias is and why they're featuring certain products over other products. It's not necessarily because it's they consider it the best, but it's the one they get paid for featuring.
And Natalie says she also looks at the date of reviews, because sometimes product quality changes over time.
Yeah, if you look at the reviews, for example, for a relatively new product, it can change over the, let's say, the course of 6 months to a year, as people get to use a product more and more, people buy it and everything, and the shine has sort of gone off it, and you get they tend to be more accurate than user reviews for a brand new product.
And she says also the reason for a negative review could be about incorrect use of the product, which would be a user issue rather than a product issue.
Yeah, that's why it's very useful to read what the reviewer actually has to say, that rather than just look at the number of stars they give.
And Carol notes that you can look at consumer reports online by going to the Ottawa Public Library. You probably have to have a library card to do that, but yeah, they are available online. And Tom says he looks for reviews with a specific URL here. And he said you can choose date range in Google. You can choose a date range in Google or in DuckDuckGo. So that will narrow down the results you get, I guess.
Yeah, and in some cases as well, the review sites, like Consumers Reports, for example, they'll give reports on brand new cars, but then they also do regular reviews of cars that are 2-3 years old, and so you can see what the reliability history is. So those reviews can be quite useful as well.
Right. Okay, well, thanks very much, Bob. Lots of information there people can ponder over. Okay, so next up we have a share from our photograph guru, Linda Buskey.
Okay, thanks, Alan. So I did promise in the last newsletter that I would expand on how to make a photo collage at an upcoming Q&A. So that's what I'm going to do tonight. So next. So again, I'm going to use the free Photoscape X software, and I'm going to show you two methods, one with the collage tab and one using the insert tab. There's also going to be a document posted along with these slides. It's about a two-page document that gives you a quick reference guide for doing it yourself later. Okay, next. So this is just the one that is under the collage tab where they do sort of most of the work. You choose a number on the right. That number represents the number of photos you want your collage, and you choose some sort of design, and you can see they give you lots of options, so it looks sort of like that when you select it as the defaults. Next, and then I just threw some photos in, so I'll show you how to do this in my demo, but that's sort of letting them have most of the control. Next. The one thing you do want to be sure of if you use that method of their collage tab is that if you're going to make a collage that's just for digital viewing, that's fine. My program defaulted to a square dimension. That's not going to be any good if you want to print your collage. So if you want to print your collage, just change the size to 8 by 10 or 11 by 14 or whatever size it is you wish to print. So just don't forget to do that. Next. Now, using the insert function does take a few more steps, but I find it's worth it. You have a lot more control. So you first have to create a blank background, and I've included how to do that in the article, so I'm not going to go through that tonight. And then again, if you're going to print, when you create it in the insert function, you're basically creating a JPEG, a photo, and so you have to crop it again to the size you want to print if you're going to print. So it's pretty easy. You just use the insert function, and we go from there, and I'll show you how to do that. So this is just an example of one that I did for my sister. Her little doggie unfortunately had a short life, but you can see she got involved in yoga and canoeing, and she had a great life. And so you can see you can overlap the photos, you can bring them forward, send them back, whatever you wish. So you have a lot more control in that insert method. Next. And this is just one that I did of a few waterfalls in a waterfall in Bergen, Norway. Next. And this was one, Chris and I did a lot of traveling in 2019, so we must have been psychic because, of course, everything locked down in 2020 for COVID. So I did this 8 by 10 as a little gift for him for Christmas with memories of some of our travels. So it's that kind of thing that you can do, which is kind of fun. Okay, so I think that was the last, is that the last slide?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so I will share my screen and we'll do the demo. Okay, are you seeing?
Yep.
Okay, so just as I usually recommend, drag your gallery over to the left side or minimize it completely because you're going to want to see the program fully. Okay, so I'm going to start off in this collage tab. So we're going to click on collage. It defaults to this. I'm going to do a duplicate of the one I showed in the PowerPoint. So we're going to click on three photos, and I'm going to choose the same one. Now you can see at the top, you can drag the spacing, so the distance between the photos. You can change the margin, which doesn't change the distance between the photos, but it changes the distance to the edge. And that might be important if you want to frame your 8 by 10 later, say. So you might want to give yourself a little room to play with there. And of course, you can adjust the roundness of the photo border, and you can change the background color. So say you want to do a pale blue or whatever. You can also use the insert tab, but let's bring our pictures in first. So we've got this, and I'm just going to bring the three birdies in. So we'll bring one in there, here, and one down here. Now I can move this, but I can't move it up and down. So I find it a little frustrating. I can move that up and down, but I can't move it left to right. So if it doesn't come in, it doesn't look right. You might have to go back out and recrop it. You can adjust by pulling some of the edges here. You can pull the bottom up and change the angle, and then maybe you can pull it down, but I find it limiting. But that's totally up to you. If this is your preferred method and you're happy with the defaults, then go for it. So if you want to add text, you just click on the insert here, say text, and then we're going to just drag this down to, oops, drag the text box down here. You can choose, you know, whatever style of text you want. Say we're going to go something like this and just say okay. And then you can change the size. You can either do that just by dragging on the corner to get the size you want, or you can actually specify a number. So if you have a series, say you want to make a binder for, you know, a little booklet of four collages, and you want to make sure that the font size was exactly the same in each one, then you might want to change the number over here. But if not, then you probably are, it's probably easier just to drag it. So then you just put the text in that you want. Only nut hatches. Make it a little smaller. And you're done. Now, when you save this, you can bring it back in and add another picture, say, or add more text, but you can't move anything around. There's no changes you can make. It's basically going to save as a flat file. So, and that's the same in the insert mode as well. So that's basically it for the easy method. Now I'm going to do the slightly more complicated, but not crazy complicated method. So we're going to go out to editor, and I'm going to just first show you the background. So you do have to create a background to layer your photos on. And as I say, you can see how to do that in the article that I wrote. And you can see I put a little frame on it, and that's just under frames up here. And I just chose something that looked like this. Okay, so you've got those choices if you want. But before I layer my photos in, what I typically like to do, and that's totally up to you, is I want to put a frame around each of the photos I'm going to use. So I'm going to pull my first photo in, just into the work area, and we're going to frame it. So I'll go back to frame, but I don't want this kind of frame on my photo. That doesn't look too good. So I'm going to go to a border. So you can see it has a little round border. I often use this one and just drag it to a very small border. Framing, and then you can choose your background. Let's just choose black so you can see it, and you can save this. Now the cool thing is you hit apply first, and then we're going to hit save. So I'm just going to do a quick control S, and we're going to save over our image. But the cool thing is when I drag my next photo in and go to framing, it remembers what I just did. So you can wham off a whole bunch in a row very quickly because it's the same framing. It remembers that and assumes that maybe you want this again. So now we've got our three photos framed, ready to go. So now I'm going to pull back in my background. We're going to go to the insert tab, and now it will layer over anything I bring into it. So I'm going to bring in this photo, and we can size it. You can rotate them. They don't have to be 90 degrees if you don't want. And I'll bring in this one. And as I say, you can overlap them, but you can switch. So if you want that one in front, just go over to three dots over here and say bring to front. Okay. So you've got lots more options than with the collage program itself, I find. So we'll just scrunch this down. You can also, if you want to line them up, it will tell you like that. See that blue line to say you're even with the one decided, or if I wanted the bottom one. So you can, you know, if you don't like things too off center, you can use that to align things. So just for now. And then the text works the same way. So you just click on the text and you change this, whatever you want to say. We'll just call it waterfall for now. And I'm just going to use the number this time and make about half the size. Maybe even a little smaller, and just drag it where you want. There are stickers in that to put in, but honestly, even the stickers in the paid version are pretty pathetic. So go to some other place on the web, on the internet, and get some free stickers if you want to use them. Okay, so I've got a couple more things that I'd like to show you. But that's the main gist of it. But what I want to show you is a different way about framing. So let's say, let's go back to edit, and let's say, I'm just going to go click on the edit here. Let's say we're starting a new one and we want to frame this photo here. So I go into frames, but say instead of a square frame, I want a shape. And I can go down to the bottom here, and I can get something nice. Now there's lots of, you can see the, all the ones marked pro. So you have a little more choice on the pro one, but this is the free one. So we're going to take this, and that's fine. But if you bring in that image onto a colored background, say we have the green, it's going to come in with this white, okay? Because it's just going to save as a JPEG. If you go over to background menu here at the bottom right and you click on transparent, it will give you the transparent background. You save this, so let's hit apply, and then you save this as a PNG, but I'll just give you a heads up on this. So if it doesn't default, save it as a PNG, and then make sure it's in, this actually is in the right folder. It will always go to the last folder that you saved a PNG, and it doesn't go to necessarily the folder you're currently working in. So just give you a heads up on that. Be careful where it saves that PNG to. And then you just bring the PNG into your colored background, and you get a nice transparent background to layer. Okay, the last thing I wanted to show you is you can actually use a photo for your background. So that's kind of fun because you can do it different ways. So let's just bring in, I've already made a white background, but you know how by reading the article. So we've got a white background here, and I'm going to hit the insert tab, and I'm going to layer in a photo. Okay, I'm going to put this photo in. It doesn't have to match exactly because we can crop it after. But I'm just going to put this in. And now what you can do over on the right here is an opacity slider. So if you want to make that a really nice soft, soft background, you can go like that. We're still in insert mode. So now I could just bring in a couple of pictures from, say, a trip to, you know, to see the tulips. Or whatever. I actually went on an excursion, so I made a, I'm with some old folks, so I made a collage with them in the collage, and with the tulips showing around, etc. So this is, it's kind of nice that you can make that little opacity. So again, when you save this, you can't go back, it can't reopen it and move the photos around. You can add, you could, I could bring this in tomorrow and add text, but you can't move things around. It's a flat JPEG. Okay, so I think that was all I was going to cover for today, but happy to answer any questions.
I didn't see anything in the chat window.
Okay, I'll stop sharing then.
Okay, thanks very much, Linda.
You're welcome.
And if people do have questions, you can ask later on, or always send Linda an email.
Yes, Bob, it does make a great gift for sure.
Okay, so next up, I have a little share here on disk partitioning. I'm sure a lot of people don't use this, but personally I find it A, necessary, but B, really, really useful. So you probably know that hard drives, on your hard drive you have drive C, which is your Windows system drive. But actually there's other things on the disk as well if you really look in there. And basically you can split up the disk into these different segments, which are called partitions. And there are a couple of different partitioning schemes. And in the original PCs, you basically had a master boot record type setup. And you were allowed to have only four primary partitions, but you could have one of those partitions be nominated as extended. So then you had three primary plus one extended, and that one extended could actually be split up again, and you could have a total of actually 24 partitions on your drive, although I'm sure most people only ever used a couple or four at the maximum. One of the downsides of MBR is that it has a limit on capacity. It only goes up to 2 terabytes, which these days, with some really big hard drives, is basically insufficient. And it's also a legacy type system because it uses BIOS, which is the basic input-output system for boot up. More modern computers have a GUID partition table, GPT, and GUID stands for Globally Unique Identifier. So every disk, every drive has a number which is unique around the world, a bit like IP addresses, I guess. So sometimes you'll see your drive being labeled with a number, which is the GUID. And they also use UEFI as the firmware interface, Unified Extensible Firmware Interface. And the advantage of this system is that you get much higher capacity. So you can have a total of 128 individual partitions and 9.7 zettabytes of hard drive capacity. Now, zettabytes are just absolutely huge. We're familiar with gigabytes because we have memory and flash drives, which are gigabytes. And we have some hard drives which are terabytes, which is 1,000 gigabytes. But to get to zettabytes, you have to go from terabytes to petabytes to exabytes to get to zettabytes. So that means that a zettabyte is 1 billion terabytes. And they haven't made hard drives quite that big yet. So I think there's lots of spare capacity in there for the future. However, most people with a modern computer, you're going to have a GPT partition setup and quite a number of partitions probably. So if you look at like Windows 10, for example, there'll be a small recovery partition and depending on how many system updates you had, you might have multiple recovery partitions. There'll be an EFI system partition, which again is really small. And then you get probably a factory partition, an OEM, original equipment manufacturer, which will let you boot back to factory standards and factory system. And there'll be another Microsoft partition, a really small one, 16 meg, which is called an MSR partition, a Microsoft Reserve partition. And interestingly, this is one that isn't visible when you look at the disk management program in Windows. But the one that we're all familiar with is the bottom one, which is the Windows partition. That's usually the biggest one, and it typically depends on the size of the drive. Usually it will take the rest of the drive once it's dealt with all these Mickey Mouse little partitions for various recovery type options. So here's an example. Here's actually my laptop drive, which is this disk zero here. And it also has an SD card, a 64 gig SD card in, which is showing up as disk one. And you can see that both of these have partitions. The SD card has that tiny 60 meg up front. And then most of the partition is 57 gigabytes and change of available storage space. But the main drive, this disk zero, you can see it has these small drives up front, various recovery type drives. Here is the Windows C drive, which is 140 gigabytes on this system. And then there's another recovery drive here. Here is a second NTFS drive, which is a Windows format drive, essentially, which I use as a dedicated data partition. So I call it data disk. And in Windows, it shows up as drive D rather than drive C. And then there's another recovery partition here, so I've obviously had a fair number of major updates. And then there's a couple of partitions at the end. One's almost 60 gigabytes, which all Windows will tell me about that is that they're healthy primary partitions. And these are my Linux partitions, which Windows is basically trying to ignore, I guess. Anyway, there you have it. There's a whole raft of partitions. Clearly, I've got more than four partitions on this GPT drive. So why would I want to add partitions? Well, in my case, I do dual boot Linux. So when you install Linux, it has to be, if you want to keep Windows, it has to be on a separate partition. So you have to partition a hard drive in at least two partitions to get Windows in one and Linux in the other. And Linux generally has a swap area, which is that smaller partition right on the end. So I have to have dual boot. I have to have dual boot capability, so I have to use different partitions. But the main reason you might want to do it is so that you have a dedicated data drive, right? So this is what I would, if you don't use Linux, this is still a really useful way of organizing your hard drive. Because basically what I do is I separate all of my data files from Windows itself and all of the applications. So I have a dedicated data drive with all of my personal data files sitting there. So what do we get from by doing that? Well, I would suggest we get better data organization, and we certainly have better control over what we're doing. Windows and the applications, they kind of organize themselves in various folders. Windows, for example, you have a Windows partition, you have program files, and you have program 86 files. And Windows basically takes care of all that stuff. It decides where the various Windows operating system files are going to live. Similarly, when you install applications, they generally end up in one of those program files type things, or they may squirrel files around here, there, everywhere on the hard drive. But the main thing is your personal data file. You are creating these things, and in my view, you should be in control of where they go. And so I don't like putting my drives in Windows documents and Windows pictures and Windows videos. I prefer to have them in a drive and a folder where that I create, and I know where they're located. So basically, I have a very clear demarcation between my operating system, the installed applications, and my personal data files. I know where all of my data files reside. And the second thing that happens is you get much easier backup. Windows typically gets updated once a month, the so-called Patch Tuesday. Sometimes you have out-of-band updates, which are fairly infrequent. And your application programs that you install usually get updated probably much less frequently. But the data files that you use, you could change some of those every session. You create new ones, you edit old ones, and the data files turn over quite rapidly. Now, in Windows and the application programs, you have installation media, CDs, DVDs, USBs. You can reinstall those very easily if you ended up with, let's say, a disk crash. But your data files, if you don't have backups, then there's no way you can retrieve those if you've truly had a calamitous disk crash. So you need a backup strategy, and what you need to do is make sure you've got current copies of all of the current data files. And we've talked about backing up entire drives using disk imaging. We can also back up just an individual partition. And that, in my view, is really simple. All my files are on my data partition. I back up the data partition. I back up everything. I don't have to worry about it. So there are various ways to make sure you have backup, and we've talked about these in the past, full disk image backups, but I can mention you can image just a partition, you don't have to do the whole thing. And if you use incremental imaging, then you will save space and use your backup drive quite efficiently. For the data files, because they do change quickly and often, so you might want to maintain really up-to-date copies of those by using some kind of file folder synchronization option. And for both of these things, there's software available, and in particular, there's free software available that works really well and will allow you to automate and schedule your data backups. So in future, we're going to talk a bit more about disk partitions. I'll tell you how to generate disk partitions. And finally, we'll end up with some thoughts about disk backup and some software that works really, really well. Okay, so that's it for disk partitioning, at least for this time. A couple of questions here. We're running short on time, so I'll deal with those next week. I'll come back to the questions next week. Okay, Chris, so do you want to do the...
Yeah, just before I do that, Pamela is on the call tonight. She'd actually phoned me about a problem she was having. It looks like, Pamela, we're not going to have time to handle your question tonight. So if you send in your question to suggestionbox@opcug.ca, we'll add it to the agenda for next week. And I did put a private direct message to you in the chat on that. Okay, so yes, as I put out on the announcement list this week, we do have a poll that we want to do. And this really came from the fact that the Ottawa Public Library, where we offer presentations, they didn't pick up on some of our presentations that we did offer. And so Alan had the idea that of those programs that they didn't pick up on, maybe we'd slot that into our April 10th general meeting. And so if there is sufficient interest, we could do that. We don't have anything currently scheduled for that month. So I'm going to bring up the poll, and if I can find it here. Poll launch. Okay, so you should now see it on the screen. And I think anybody who is a co-host is not going to be able to vote on it. So there are a number of presentations on the list there. If you are interested in seeing any of them, or all of them, whatever, go ahead and vote on those. You should be able to select any or all of them. And I'll just leave that on the screen for a couple of minutes before we close off the poll. And no guarantee that we'll actually select these, but it's just get a gauge how much interest there is in that in these topics.
All of the above.
All of the above. Yep, that's fine. Okay, I still see some numbers coming in. We're up to 19 votes on there. How many do we have on the call tonight? We have
36 participants.
36, yeah, on the call. But I think Stu is on twice usually, so we have 35. Okay, so I'll leave it for about one more minute.
Interestingly, I might be on twice, but I didn't get the poll on my Android, only on my Windows machine.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe the same account, it just picks one device and sends it to...
Oh, that's probably what it is, yeah, because you do come in under the same account name.
Same account name.
Yeah.
Is it a 10-foot pole?
Okay, I am going to end the poll. If you didn't get a chance to vote, by all means, you could send in any preferences you have to suggestionbox@opcug.ca, and I'll just share the results there so everybody can see. Looks like Windows Performance Tune-Up is the highest, but we have certainly at least five interests in all of the topics. So thank you very much for that, folks. We will definitely take that under advisement. And
okay. Thanks, Chris.
Let me just screen cap, I think, get this from the website, but I'll stop the sharing on that. And I'll let Alan wrap up the session.
Okay, so next week will be our regular monthly meeting. And we have Sebastian Lemay, who's a constable with the Ottawa Police, going to be talking about fraud, online fraud, I guess, and how to take care of various kinds of scams. So that should be interesting. A different perspective, anyway, from law enforcement, as opposed to we as computer users. And because it's a regular meeting, we will not have a Q&A next week, so there'll be no Q&A on the 10th. Our next Q&A will be the 17th, so that gives you lots of time to take action on your New Year's resolutions and send us questions and shares and loony links and YouTube channels and all those other good things. Okay, so that's it. I hope everybody found tonight's efforts useful, and we'll see you next week at the monthly meeting.
Okay, thanks, folks. Good evening. And we'll see you all at the main meeting next week.